Welcome back, everyone. Today we're diving into a pretty significant chapter, India's journey to independence from British rule.
A journey, you could say, marked by a complex interplay of resistance, reform, and evolving identities.
Exactly. And we'll be focusing specifically on the period between 1857 and 1947, those crucial decades leading up to India's freedom.
A period where those early whispers of nationalism start to transform into a powerful chorus demanding change.
Right, and to kick things off, let's talk about the common narrative we often hear. The Battle of Plassey in 1757, often seen as the moment British control over India was solidified. But do our sources really support this idea of complete submission?
Not quite. It's crucial to remember that resistance to British rule was there from the outset, even after Plassey.
So it wasn't this immediate acceptance of British authority.
Not at all. What's fascinating is the sheer diversity of that resistance. You see armed rebellions, obviously, but also nonviolent protests emerging.
And intellectual movements as well, right? Challenging the very legitimacy of British rule through writing and discourse.
Exactly. Thinkers and writers questioning the moral and political foundations of British presence in India. It's a multi-pronged pushback against colonial dominance.
This brings to mind the East India Company. We often think of them as this trading powerhouse. But how did they transition into a governing force, the East India Company's Raj, so to speak?
Well, that's where things get even more complex. The late 18th century saw the company establish a sophisticated administrative structure, particularly in Bengal.
And that's when we have figures like Warren Hastings stepping onto the scene.
Yeah.
The first governor general.
Precisely. But he faced an uphill battle. A divided council, accusations of corruption leading to an impeachment trial back in England. It was a tumultuous time.
It sounds like the British were navigating uncharted territory, trying to assert their authority while also grappling with existing Indian systems and traditions.
Absolutely. There's this fascinating mix of imposing their will and adapting to what they found. For instance, they acknowledged Mughal suzerainty in some instances, continued to use Persian as the official language, and even patronized religious institutions.
So a sort of pragmatic approach to consolidating their power.
You could say that. It was a delicate balancing act. And speaking of navigating these complexities, we can't forget the emergence of Western-educated Indian intellectuals during this time.
It's almost paradoxical, isn't it? Products of the very system they were starting to critique.
Exactly. Figures like Surendranath Banerjee come to mind. He excelled in his studies, a brilliant scholar, but guess what? He was denied entry into the Indian civil service, purely based on discriminatory practices.
Wow. Denied opportunity despite his qualifications.
It's a stark reminder of the inequalities woven into the fabric of the colonial system. And experiences like his fueled nationalist sentiments even further. It's no coincidence that we see the rise of organizations like the Indian Association during this period.
So these injustices, these roadblocks, were actually galvanizing a movement for change.
Absolutely. It's like pushing down on a spring. The harder you push, the stronger the rebound. And one event that truly exemplifies this is the Olbert Bill controversy.
This is in 1883, right? I'm curious, what was so controversial about a bill that aimed to allow Indian judges to preside over cases involving Europeans? On the surface, it sounds like a step towards equality within the legal system.
You would think so, wouldn't you? But it exposed a deep-seated racial prejudice at the heart of the colonial mindset. The British community in India erupted in protest.
What were their primary concerns?
People like John Beams, a British civil servant at the time, saw it as a direct threat to British prestige, almost like a crack in the foundation of their authority. He even feared it could incite a full-blown revolution.
So this seemingly minor legal reform actually shook the very core of British power in India.
It certainly did. And although it ended in a compromise, the Olbert Bill controversy had a profound impact on the nationalist movement. Just 2 years later, in 1885, we see the birth of the Indian National Congress, a landmark moment in the fight for self-rule.
A coming together of voices, united by a shared desire for change.
And that's just the beginning.
So we've got this growing movement for change, the Indian National Congress gaining momentum. But it wasn't a monolithic entity, right?
Mm.
Alongside this broader sense of Indian nationalism, we also see the rise of distinct religious identities within the movement.
That's right. It adds another layer to this already complex story. As the idea of self-rule gains traction, different communities begin grappling with their own vision of a future independent India. One prime example of this is the rise of Muslim nationalism in the late 19th and early 20th centuries.
Okay, so what were the driving forces behind this separate sense of Muslim nationalism?
Well, I think it's essential to consider the historical context here. Concerns about political representation under British rule, anxieties over economic opportunities, and even worries about potential marginalization in a post-colonial India. All of these played a significant role in shaping Muslim nationalist sentiment.
It makes sense. When you're talking about such a massive societal shift, those questions of identity and representation are bound to come to the forefront.
Precisely. And figures like Syed Ahmad Khan really emerged as a leading voice during this time. He advocated for Muslim interests, stressed the importance of education as a tool for empowerment, and really shaped the direction of Muslim political thought.
And his founding of the Aligarh College in 1875 seems like a pivotal moment in that regard. Was it seen as an attempt to, bridge the gap between Western education and Islamic principles?
Exactly. It became this intellectual hub where Muslim scholars could engage with modern ideas while staying rooted in their own cultural and religious identity. You could say that the college really nurtured a generation of Muslim leaders who would go on to play a crucial role in shaping India's future.
So we have these like parallel narratives of nationalism emerging, each with its own set of aspirations and concerns. How did this dynamic impact the overall movement for independence? Did it lead to friction, or were there moments of collaboration as well?
Oh, it definitely added layers of complexity. There were times when those differences led to tension and disagreements. But it's important to remember that despite their differences, both the Indian National Congress and the Muslim League ultimately shared the goal of ending British rule. They might not have always agreed on the path, but the destination was the same.
And then, of course, you have this huge global event that throws everything into disarray, World War II. How did this conflict shape the dynamics of the independence movement?
It was a major turning point. India, as part of the British Empire, was drawn into the war effort, and this really intensified the demand for self-rule. You had Indians being asked to fight for an empire that denied them basic freedoms.
Yeah, it must have been a deeply conflicting experience for many. Did the British government make any attempts to address this growing discontent? Was there any effort to try to find a compromise?
Yes, they did. In 1942, the British government sent the Cripps mission, led by Sir Stafford Cripps, to India to negotiate a settlement. They offered the promise of dominion status after the war.
Dominion status, meaning.
Essentially, self-governance within the British Commonwealth, similar to what Canada and Australia had achieved. So, not complete independence, but a step towards greater autonomy.
Okay, so not full independence, but a potential step in that direction. Did this proposal satisfy the demands of the Congress and the Muslim League?
Not really, no.
Yeah.
The Congress, led by Mahatma Gandhi and Jawaharlal Nehru, pushed for immediate and complete independence. They argued that a promise delayed was a promise denied and insisted on full control over defense and a truly representative government. They saw dominion status as a half measure.
And the Muslim League. What was their stance on the Cripps Mission's proposal?
Well, for Jinnah and the League, dominion status raised concerns about potential Hindu domination. It fueled their anxieties about being marginalized in a post-colonial India.
So the Cripps Mission, despite its good intentions, didn't really bridge the growing divide between these competing visions for a future independent India.
Unfortunately, not. The failure of the Cripps mission was a pivotal moment. It made it clear that a clean break from British rule was becoming inevitable. The stage was set for India's eventual independence, which, as we know, came in 1947.
But as we know, independence came at a steep price. Partition. The division of British India into India and Pakistan triggered one of the largest mass migrations in history, marked by widespread violence and communal tensions. It's a tragic chapter in this story.
It absolutely is. Millions were displaced, caught in the crosshairs of religious and political upheaval. The scars of partition still run deep today, shaping the geopolitical landscape of the region even now.
It's heavy stuff, really, to think about the partition and all the upheaval that came with it. After decades of struggle for independence, India finally achieves its goal, but it's such a tremendous cost.
Yeah, a bittersweet victory, you could say. It makes you wonder, how do you even begin to build a nation from the ground up when you're in the midst of such turmoil?
Exactly. I mean, a new nation, yes, but what kind of nation? What were the guiding principles, the vision that shaped this newly independent India?
Well, Jawaharlal Nehru, India's first prime minister, played a key role in defining that vision. He imagined a modern, secular, democratic India, drawing inspiration from a blend of sources, Western democratic ideals, socialist principles. You even see echoes of ancient Indian philosophies in there.
So kind of a fusion of global ideas with local traditions. How did that translate into actual policies and actions on the ground?
One of the most significant achievements was the drafting and adoption of the Indian Constitution in 1950. It laid the foundation for a secular democratic republic with a strong emphasis on social justice and individual rights. A really remarkable document.
It's almost like you can see the imprint of that long fight for independence shaping these core values. I mean, unity and diversity, for instance, seems so central to India's identity.
Oh, absolutely. The struggle against colonial rule brought together people from all walks of life, different religions, languages, backgrounds. That shared experience of resistance really fostered a sense of national unity, even amidst all the diversity.
But nation building wasn't just about, ideals and principles. There were some very real and pressing challenges facing India at the time. Poverty, illiteracy, lack of infrastructure. How did they tackle those issues?
India adopted a mixed economy model. They focused on state-led industrialization, but alongside private enterprise as well. Nehru's government launched these ambitious 5-year plans aimed at boosting agricultural productivity, investing in infrastructure, expanding access to education and healthcare. A lot on their plate.
It sounds like a real balancing act, promoting economic growth and development while also staying true to those values of democracy and social justice.
Yeah, a delicate balance for sure. And it wasn't always easy. There were setbacks, controversies, the constant challenge of trying to meet competing demands and priorities. But throughout it all, India held on to its democratic principles. Regular elections, a vibrant civil society. These were crucial elements of the nation-building process.
So looking back on everything we've discussed, it's clear that India's path to independence and the whole process of building a nation afterward was, well, it was complicated, full of twists and turns.
It was a story of resilience, adaptation, constant evolution, and honestly, it's a story that's still unfolding. Even today, India grapples with many legacies of this period: economic inequality, religious tensions, finding that balance between tradition and modernity. The past is never truly past, is it?
And I think that's what makes studying history so compelling. It's not just about the past. It's about understanding the forces that have shaped our present and that continue to influence the future. So many echoes of history all around us.
Exactly. By learning from the past, we can better understand the present and hopefully make more informed choices about the future. It's a journey worth taking.
Well said. And on that note, a huge thank you to everyone for joining us on this deep dive into India's path to independence and beyond. It's been an incredible journey for us, and we hope you found it as fascinating and thought-provoking as we have.